After a year in Colorado, Dad wanted to see me again. In fact, he insisted on taking me to Italy, France, Germany, Spain, and Scotland. A 10-week trip beginning in mid-June, which meant I wouldn't go to Beechwood at all summer 16. "The trip is grand timing," said Mummy brightly as she packed my suitcase. "Why?" I lay on the floor of my bedroom and let her do the work. My head hurt. "Granddad's redoing Claremont." She rolled socks into balls. "I told you that a million times already." I didn't remember. "How come?" "Some idea of his. He's spending the summer in Windermere." "With you waiting on him?" Mummy nodded. "He can't stay with Bess or Carrie. And you know he takes looking after. Anyway, he'll get a wonderful education in Europe." "I'd rather go to Beechwood." "No, you wouldn't," she said firm. In Europe, I vomited into small buckets and brushed my teeth repeatedly with chalky British toothpaste. I lay prone on the bathroom floors of several museums, feeling the cold tile underneath my cheek as my brain liquefied and seeped out my ear, bubbling. Migraines left my blood spreading across unfamiliar hotel sheets, dripping on the floors, oozing into carpets, soaking through leftover croissants and Italian lace cookies. I could hear Dad calling me, but I never answered until my medicine took effect. I missed the Liars that summer. We never kept in touch over the school year, not much anyway, though we'd tried when we were younger. We'd text or tag each other in summer photos, especially in September, but we'd inevitably fade out after a month or so. Somehow, Beechwood's magic never carried over into our everyday lives. We didn't want to hear about school friends and clubs and sports teams. Instead, we knew our affection would revive when we saw one another on the dock the following June. Salt spray in the air, pale sun glinting off the water. But the year after my accident, I missed days and even weeks of school. I failed my classes, and the principal informed me I would have to repeat junior year. I stopped soccer and tennis. I couldn't babysit. I couldn't drive. The friends I'd had weakened into acquaintances. I texted Mirren a few times, called and left her messages that later I was ashamed of. They were so lonely and needy. I called Johnny, too, but his voicemail was full. I decided not to call again. I didn't want to keep saying things that made me feel weak. When Dad took me to Europe, I knew the Liars were on island. Granddad hasn't wired Beechwood, and cell phones don't get reception there, so I began writing emails. Different from my pitiful voice messages, these were charming, darling notes from a person without headaches. Mostly. "Mirren, waving at you from Barcelona, where my father ate snails in broth. Our hotel has gold everything, even salt shakers. It is gloriously vile. Write and tell me how the littles are misbehaving and where you are applying to college and whether you have found true love. Cadence." "Johnny, bonjour from Paris, where my father ate a frog. I saw the winged victory. Phenomenal body. No arms. Miss you guys. How is Gat?" Cadence. "Mirren, hello from a castle in Scotland where my father ate a haggis. That is, my father ate the heart, liver, and lungs of a sheep mixed with oatmeal and boiled in a sheep's stomach. So, you know, he is the sort of person who eats hearts." Cadence. "Johnny, I am in Berlin, where my father ate a blood sausage. Snorkel for me, eat blueberry pie, play tennis, build a bonfire, then report back. I am desperately bored and will devise creative punishments if you do not comply." Cadence. I wasn't entirely surprised they didn't answer. Besides the fact that to get online you have to go to the Vineyard, Beechwood is very much its own world. Once you are there, the rest of the universe seems nothing but an unpleasant dream. Europe might not even exist. Chapter 15. Welcome once again to the beautiful Sinclair family. We believe in outdoor exercise. We believe that time heals. We believe, although we will not say so explicitly, in prescription drugs and the cocktail hour. We do not discuss our problems in restaurants. We do not believe in displays of distress. Our upper lips are stiff, and it is possible people are curious about us because we do not show them our hearts. It is possible that we enjoy the way people are curious about us. Here in Burlington, it's just me, Mummy, and the dogs now. We haven't the weight of Granddad in Boston or the impact of the whole family on Beechwood, but I know how people see us nonetheless. Mummy and I are two of a kind in the big house with the porch at the top of the hill, the willowy mother and the sickly daughter. We are high of cheekbone, broad of shoulder. We smile and show our teeth when we run errands in town. The sickly daughter doesn't talk much. People who know her at school tend to keep away. They didn't know her well before she got sick anyway. She was quiet even then. Now she misses school half the time. When she's there, her pale skin and watery eyes make her look glamorously tragic, like a literary heroine wasting from consumption. Sometimes she falls down at school, crying. She frightens the other students. Even the kindest ones are tired of walking her to the nurse's office. Still, she has an aura of mystery that stops her from being teased or singled out for typical high school unpleasantness. Her mother is a Sinclair. Of course, I feel no sense of my own mystery eating a can of chicken soup late at night, or lying in the fluorescent light of the school nurse's office. It is hardly glamorous the way Mummy and I quarrel now that Dad is gone. I wake to find her standing in my bedroom doorway, staring. "Don't hover. I love you. I'm taking care of you," she says, her hand on her heart. "Well, stop it." If I could shut my door on her, I would, but I cannot stand up. Often I find notes lying around that appear to be records of what foods I've eaten on a particular day. Toast and jam, but only one half. Apple and popcorn. Salad with raisins. Chocolate bar. Pasta. Hydration. Protein. Too much ginger ale. It is not glamorous that I can't drive a car. It is not mysterious to be home on a Saturday night reading a novel in a pile of smelly golden retrievers. However, I am not immune to the feeling of being viewed as a mystery, as a Sinclair, as part of a privileged clan of special people, and as part of a magical, important narrative just because I am part of this clan. My mother is not immune to it either. This is who we have been brought up to be. Sinclairs. Sinclairs. Part 2. Vermont. Chapter 16. When I was 8, Dad gave me a stack of fairy tale books for Christmas. They came with colored covers. The yellow fairy book, the blue fairy book, the crimson, the green, the gray, the brown, and the orange. Inside were tales from all over the world, variations on variations of familiar stories. Read them, and you hear echoes of one story inside another, then echoes of another inside that. So many have the same premise. Once upon a time, there were three. Three of something. Three pigs, three bears, three brothers, three soldiers, three billy goats, three princesses. Since I got back from Europe, I have been writing some of my own variations. I have time on my hands, so let me tell you a story. A variation, I am saying, of a story you have heard before. Once upon a time, there was a king who had three beautiful daughters. As he grew old, he began to wonder which should inherit the kingdom, since none had married and he had no heir. The king decided to ask his daughters to demonstrate their love for him. To the eldest princess, he said, "Tell me how you love me." She loved him as much as all the treasure in the kingdom. To the middle princess, he said, "Tell me how you love me." She loved him with the strength of iron. To the youngest princess, he said, "Tell me how you love me." This youngest princess thought for a long time before answering. Finally, she said, she loved him as meat loves salt. "Then you do not love me at all," the king said. He threw his daughter from the castle and had the bridge drawn up behind her so that she could not return. Now, this youngest princess goes into the forest with not so much as a coat or a loaf of bread. She wanders through a hard winter, taking shelter beneath trees. She arrives at an inn and gets hired as assistant to the cook. As the days and weeks go by, the princess learns the ways of the kitchen. Eventually, she surpasses her employer in skill, and her food is known throughout the land. Years pass, and the eldest princess comes to be married. For the festivities, the cook from the inn makes the wedding meal. Finally, a large roast pig is served. It is the king's favorite dish, but this time it has been cooked with no salt. The king tastes it again. "Who would dare to serve such an ill-cooked roast at the future queen's wedding?" he cries. The princess cook appears before her father, but she is so changed he does not recognize her. "I would not serve you salt, Your Majesty," she explains. "For did you not exile your youngest daughter for saying that it was of value?" At her words, the king realizes that not only is she his daughter, she is in fact the daughter who loves him best. And what then? The eldest daughter and the middle sister have been living with the king all this time. One has been in favor one week, the other the next. They have been driven apart by their father's constant comparisons. Now the youngest has returned. The king yanks the kingdom from his eldest, who has just been married. She is not to be queen after all. The elder sisters rage. At first, the youngest basks in fatherly love. Before long, however, she realizes the king is demented and power mad. She is to be queen, but she is also stuck tending to a crazy old tyrant for the rest of her days. She will not leave him, no matter how sick he becomes. Does she stay because she loves him as meat loves salt? Or does she stay because he has now promised her the kingdom? It is hard for her to tell the difference. Chapter 17. The fall after the European trip, I started a project. I give away something of mine every day. I mailed Mirren an old Barbie with extra long hair, one we used to fight over when we were kids. I mailed Johnny a striped scarf I used to wear a lot. Johnny likes stripes. For the old people in my family, Mommy, the aunties, Granddad, the accumulation of beautiful objects is a life goal. Whoever dies with the most stuff wins. Wins what, is what I'd like to know. I used to be a person who liked pretty things, like Mommy does, like all the Sinclairs do. But that's not me anymore. Mommy has our Burlington house filled with silver and crystal, coffee table books and cashmere blankets. Thick rugs cover every floor, and paintings from several local artists she patronizes line our walls. She likes antique china and displays it in the dining room. She's replaced the perfectly drivable Saab with a BMW. Not one of these symbols of prosperity and taste has any use at all. "Beauty is a valid use," Mummy argues. "It creates a sense of place, a sense of personal history. Pleasure, even, Cadence. Have you ever heard of pleasure? But I think she's lying, to me and to herself, about why she owns these objects. The jolt of a new purchase makes Mommy feel powerful, if only for a moment. I think there is status to having a house full of pretty things, to buying expensive paintings of seashells from her arty friends and spoons from Tiffany's. Antiques and oriental rugs tell people that my mother may be a dog breeder who dropped out of Bryn Mawr, but she's got power, because she's got money. Giveaway. My bed pillow. I carry it while I run errands. There is a girl leaning against the wall outside the library. She has a cardboard cup by her ankles for spare change. She's not much older than I am. "Do you want this pillow?" I ask. "I washed the pillowcase." She takes it and sits on it. My bed is uncomfortable that night, but it's for the best. Giveaway. Paperback copy of King Lear I read for school sophomore year, found under the bed. Donated to the public library. I don't need to read it again. Giveaway. A photo of Granny Tipper at the Farm Institute party wearing an evening dress and holding a piglet. I stop by Goodwill on my way home. "Hey there, Cadence," says Patty behind the counter. "Just dropping off?" This was my gran. "She was a beautiful lady," says Patty, peering. "You sure you don't want to take the photo out? You could just donate the frame." "I'm sure." Gran is dead. Having a picture of her won't change anything. "Did you go buy Goodwill again?" Mummy asks when I get home. She is slicing peaches with a special fruit knife. "Yeah." "What did you get rid of?" "Just an old picture of Gran."
"With a piglet?"
Her mouth twitches.
"Oh, Katie.
It was mine to give away." Mummy sighs. "You give away one of the dogs and you will never hear the end of it." I squat down to dog height. Bosch, Grendel, and Poppy greet me with soft indoor woofs. They're our family dogs, portly and well-behaved, purebred goldens. Poppy had several litters for my mother's business, but the puppies and the other breeding dogs live with Mummy's partner at a farm outside Burlington. "I would never," I say. I whisper how I love them into their soft, doggy ears. Chapter 18. If I Google traumatic brain injury, most websites tell me selective amnesia is a consequence. When there's damage to the brain, it's not uncommon for a patient to forget stuff. She will be unable to piece together a coherent story of the trauma. But I don't want people to know I'm like this, still like this, after all the appointments and scans and medicines. I don't want to be labeled with a disability. I don't want more drugs. I don't want doctors or concerned teachers. God knows I've had enough doctors. What I remember from the summer of the accident. Falling in love with Gat at the Red Gate kitchen door. His beach rose for Raquel and my wine-soaked night spinning in anger. Acting normal, making ice cream, playing tennis. The triple-decker s'mores and Gat's anger when we told him to shut up. Night swimming. Kissing Gat in the attic. Hearing the Cracker Jack story and helping Granddad down the stairs. The tire swing, the basement, the perimeter. Gat and I in one another's arms. Gat seeing me bleed, asking me questions, dressing my wounds. I don't remember much else. I can see Mirren's hand, her chipped gold nail polish holding a jug of gas for the motorboats. Mummy, her face tight, asking, "The Black Pearls?" Johnny's feet running down the stairs from Claremont to the boathouse. Granddad holding on to a tree, his face lit by the glow of a bonfire. And all four of us liars laughing so hard we felt dizzy and sick. But what was so funny? What was it, and where were we? I do not know. I used to ask Mommy when I didn't remember the rest of summer 15. My forgetfulness frightened me. I'd suggest stopping my meds or trying new meds or seeing a different physician. I'd beg to know what I'd forgotten. Then, one day in late fall, the fall I spent undergoing tests for death sentence illnesses, Mommy began to cry.
You ask me over and over. You never remember what I say.
I'm sorry. She poured herself a glass of wine as she talked.
You began asking me the day you woke in the hospital. What happened? What happened?
I told you the truth, Cadence. I always did. And you'd repeat it back to me. But the next day, you'd ask again.
I'm sorry, I said again.
You still ask me almost every day.
It is true. I have no memory of my accident. I don't remember what happened before and after. I don't remember my doctor's visits. I knew they must have happened because, of course, they happened. And here I am with a diagnosis and medications. But nearly all my medical treatment is a blank. I looked at Mummy, at her infuriatingly concerned face, her leaking eyes, the tipsy slackness of her mouth.
You have to stop asking, she said. The doctors think it's better if you remember on your own anyway.
I made her tell me one last time, and I wrote down her answers so I could look back at them when I wanted to. That's why I can tell you about the night swimming accident, the rocks, the hypothermia, respiratory difficulty, and the unconfirmed traumatic brain injury. I never asked her anything again. There's a lot I don't understand, but this way she stays pretty sober.
Chapter 19. Dad plans to take me to Australia and New Zealand for the whole of summer 17. I don't want to go. I want to return to Beechwood. I want to see Mirren and lie in the sun, planning our futures. I want to argue with Johnny and go snorkeling and make ice cream. I want to build bonfires on the shore of the tiny beach. I want to pile in the hammock on the Claremont porch and be the liars once again, if it's possible. I want to remember my accident. I want to know why Gat disappeared. I don't know why he wasn't with me, swimming. I don't know why I went to the tiny beach alone. Why I swam in my underwear and left no clothes on the sand. And why he bailed when I got hurt. I wonder if he loved me. I wonder if he loved Raquel. Dad and I are supposed to leave for Australia in 5 days. I should never have agreed to go. I make myself wretched, sobbing. I tell Mommy I don't need to see the world. I need to see family. I miss Granddad. No. I'll be sick if I travel to Australia. My headaches will explode. I shouldn't get on a plane. I shouldn't eat strange food. I shouldn't be jet-lagged. What if we lose my medication? Stop arguing. The trip is paid for. I walk the dogs in the early morning. I load the dishwasher and later unload it. I put on a dress and rub blusher into my cheeks. I eat everything on my plate. I let Mommy put her arms around me and stroke my hair. I tell her I want to spend the summer with her, not Dad. Please. The next day, Granddad comes to Burlington to stay in the guest room. He's been on the island since mid-May and has to take a boat, a car, and a plane to get here. He hasn't come to visit us since before Granny Tipper died. Mummy picks him up at the airport while I stay home and set the table for supper. She's picked up roast chicken and side dishes at a gourmet shop in town. Granddad has lost weight since I saw him last. His white hair stands out in puffs around his ears, tufty. He looks like a baby bird. His skin is baggy on his frame, and he has a pot-bellied slump. That's not how I remember him. He always seemed invincible, with firm, broad shoulders and lots of teeth. Granddad is the sort of person who has mottos. "Don't take no for an answer," he always says to us, and "never take a seat in the back of the room. Winners sit up front." We liars used to roll our eyes at these pronouncements. "Be decisive. No one likes a waffler. Never complain. Never explain." But we still saw him as full of wisdom on grown-up topics. Granddad is wearing Madras shorts and loafers. His legs are spindly old man legs. He pats my back and demands a scotch and soda. We eat and he talks about some friends of his in Boston, the new kitchen in his Beechwood house, nothing important. Afterward, Mommy cleans up while I show him the backyard garden. The evening sun is still out. Granddad picks a peony and hands it to me.
"For my first grandchild."
"Don't pick the flowers, okay?"
"Penny won't mind."
"Yes, she will."
"Cadence was the first," he says, looking up at the sky, not into my eyes. "I remember when she came to visit us in Boston. She was dressed in a pink romper suit, and her hair stuck up straight off her head. Johnny wasn't born till 3 weeks later."
"I'm right here, Granddad."
"Cadence was the first. And it didn't matter that she was a girl. I would give her everything, just like a grandson. I carried her in my arms and danced. She was the future of our family."
I nod.
"We could see she was a Sinclair. She had that hair. But it wasn't only that. It was the chin, the tiny hands. We knew she'd be tall. All of us were tall until Bess married that short fellow. And Carrie made the same mistake."
"You mean Brody and Jonathan?"
"Good riddance, eh?"
Granddad smiles.
"All our people were tall. Did you know my mother's side of the family came over on the Mayflower to make this life in America?"
"I know it's not important if our people came over on the Mayflower. It's not important to be tall or blonde. That is why I dyed my hair. I don't want to be the eldest, heiress to the island, the fortune, and the expectations. But then again, perhaps I do." Granddad has had too much to drink after a long travel day. "Shall we go inside?" I ask. "You want to sit down?" He picks a second peony and hands it to me.
"For forgiveness, my dear."
I pat him on his hunched back. "Don't pick any more, okay?" Granddad bends down and touches some white tulips. "Seriously, don't," I say. He picks a third peony sharply, defiantly, hands it to me.
"You are my Cadence, the first."
"Yes."
"What happened to your hair?"
"I colored it."
"I didn't recognize you."
"That's okay." Granddad points to the peonies, now all in my hand.
"Three flowers for you. You should have three."
He looks pitiful. He looks powerful. I love him, but I am not sure I like him. I take his hand and lead him inside. Chapter 20. Once upon a time, there was a king who had three beautiful daughters. He loved each of them dearly. One day, when the young ladies were of age to be married, a terrible three-headed dragon laid siege to the kingdom, burning villages with fiery breath. It spoiled crops and burned churches. It killed babies, old people, and everyone in between. The king promised a princess's hand in marriage to whoever slayed the dragon. Heroes and warriors came in suits of armor, riding brave horses and bearing swords and arrows. One by one, these men were slaughtered and eaten. Finally, the king reasoned that a maiden might melt the dragon's heart and succeed where warriors had failed. He sent his eldest daughter to beg the dragon for mercy, but the dragon listened to not a word of her pleas. It swallowed her whole. Then the king sent his second daughter to beg the dragon for mercy, but the dragon did the same, swallowed her before she could get a word out. The king then sent his youngest daughter to beg the dragon for mercy, and she was so lovely and clever that he was sure she would succeed where the others had perished. No, indeed. The dragon simply ate her. The king was left aching with regret. He was now alone in the world. Now, let me ask you this. Who killed the girls? The dragon or their father? After Granddad leaves the next day, Mummy calls Dad and cancels the Australia trip. There is yelling, there is negotiation. Eventually, they decide I will go to Beechwood for 4 weeks of the summer, then visit Dad at his home in Colorado, where I've never been. He insists. He will not lose the whole summer with me, or there will be lawyers involved. Mommy rings the aunts. She has long, private conversations with them on the porch of our house. I can't hear anything except a few phrases. Cadence is so fragile, needs lots of rest. Only 4 weeks, not the whole summer. Nothing should disturb her. The healing is very gradual. Also, Pinot Grigio, Sancerre, maybe some Riesling, definitely no Chardonnay. Chapter 21. My room is nearly empty now. There are sheets and a comforter on my bed, a laptop on my desk, a few pens, a chair. I own a couple pairs of jeans and shorts. I have t-shirts and flannel shirts, some warm sweaters, a bathing suit, a pair of sneakers, a pair of Crocs, and a pair of boots, two dresses and some heels, warm coat, hunting jacket, and canvas duffel. The shelves are bare. No pictures, no posters, no old toys. Giveaway. A travel toothbrush kit Mummy bought me yesterday. I already have a toothbrush. I don't know why she would buy me another. That woman buys things just to buy things. It's disgusting. I walk over to the library and find the girl who took my pillow. She's still leaning against the outside wall. I set the toothbrush kit in her cup. Giveaway. Gat's olive hunting jacket. The one I wore that night we held hands and looked at the stars and talked about God. I never returned it. I should have given it away first of everything, I know that. But I couldn't make myself. It was all I had left of him. But that was weak and foolish. Gat doesn't love me. I don't love him either. And maybe I never did. I'll see him day after tomorrow. And I don't love him. And I don't want his jacket. Chapter 22. The phone rings at 10 the night before we leave for Beechwood. Mommy is in the shower. I pick up. Heavy breathing, then a laugh. Who is this?
Katie?
It's a kid, I realize.
Yes? This is Taft.
Mirren's brother. He has no manners. How come you're awake?
Is it true you're a drug addict?
Taft asks me.
No. Are you sure?
You're calling to ask if I'm a drug addict? I haven't talked to Taft since my accident.
We are on Beechwood, he says. We got here this morning.
I am glad he's changing the subject. I make my voice bright. We're coming tomorrow. Is it nice? Did you go swimming yet?
No.
Did you go on the tire swing?
No,
says Taft.
Are you sure you're not a drug addict?
Where did you even get that idea?
Bonnie, she says I should watch out for you.
Don't listen to Bonnie, I say. Listen to Mirren.
That's what I'm talking about.
But Bonnie's the only one who believes me about Cuddledown, he says.
And I wanted to call you. Only not if you're a drug addict, because drug addicts don't know what's going on.
I'm not a drug addict, you pipsqueak, I say, though possibly I am lying.
Cuddle Down is haunted, says Taft. Can I come and sleep with you at Windermere?
I like Taft. I do. He's slightly bonkers and covered with freckles, and Mirren loves him way more than she loves the twins. It's not haunted. The wind just blows through the house, I say. It blows through Windermere, too. The windows rattle.
It is too haunted, Taft says. Mommy doesn't believe me, and neither does Liberty.
When he was younger, he was always the kid who thought there were monsters in the closet. Later, he was convinced there was a sea monster under the dock. Ask Mirren to help you, I tell him. She'll read you a bedtime story or sing to you.
You think so?
She will. And when I get there, I'll take you tubing and snorkeling, and it'll be a grand summer, Taft.
Okay, he says.
Don't be scared of stupid old Cuddle Down, I tell him. Show it who's boss, and I'll see you tomorrow. He hangs up without saying goodbye.
Part 3. Summer 17. Chapter 23. In Woods Hole, the port town, Mummy and I let the Goldens out of the car and drag our bags down to where Aunt Carrie is standing on the dock. Carrie gives Mummy a long hug before she helps us load our bags and the dogs into the big motorboat.
You're more beautiful than ever, she says, and thank God you're here.
Oh, quiet, says Mummy.
I know you've been sick,
Carrie says to me. She is the tallest of my aunts and the eldest Sinclair daughter. Her sweater is long and cashmere. The lines on the sides of her mouth are deep. She's wearing some ancient jade jewelry that belonged to Gran.
Nothing wrong with me that a Percocet and a couple of slugs of vodka doesn't cure, I say.
Carrie laughs, but Mummy leans in and says, she's not taking Percocet. She's taking a non-addictive medicine the doctor prescribes. It isn't true. The non-addictive medicines didn't work.
She looks too thin, says Carrie.
It's all the vodka, I say. It fills me up.
She can't eat much when she's hurting, says Mummy. The pain makes her nauseated.
Bess made that blueberry pie you like, Aunt Carrie tells me. She gives Mummy another hug.
You guys are so huggy all of a sudden, I say.
You never used to be huggy. Aunt Carrie hugs me, too. She smells of expensive lemony perfume. I haven't seen her in a long time. The drive out of the harbor is cold and sparkly. I sit at the back of the boat while Mummy stands next to Aunt Carrie behind the wheel. I trail my hand in the water. It sprays the arm of my duffel coat, soaking the canvas. I will see Gat soon. Gat. My Gat. Who is not my Gat. The houses, the littles, the ants, the liars. I will hear the sound of seagulls, taste slumps and pie and homemade ice cream. I'll hear the pong of tennis balls, the bark of Goldens, the echo of my breath in a snorkel. We'll make bonfires that will smell of ashes. Will I still be at home? Before long, Beechwood is ahead of us, the familiar outline looming. The first house I see is Windermere with its multitude of peaked roofs. That room on the far right is Mummy's. There are her pale blue curtains. My own window looks to the inside of the island. Carrie steers the boat around the tip, and I can see Cuddle Down there at the lowest point of the land with its chubby box-like structure. A bitty sandy cove, the tiny beach, is tucked in at the bottom of a long wooden staircase. The view changes as we circle to the eastern side of the island. I can't see much of Redgate among the trees, but I glimpse its red trim. Then the big beach accessed by another wooden staircase. Claremont sits at the highest point with water views in three directions. I crane my neck to look for its friendly turret. But it isn't there. The trees that used to shade the big sloping yard, they're gone too. Instead of the Victorian six-bedroom with the wraparound porch and the farmhouse kitchen, instead of the house where Granddad spent every summer since forever, I see a sleek modern building perched on a rocky hill. There's a Japanese garden on one side, bare rock on the other. The house is glass and iron, cold. Carrie cuts the engine down, which makes it easier to talk.
"That's new Claremont," she says. "It was just a shell last year. I never imagined he wouldn't have a lawn," says Mummy. "Wait till you see the inside. The walls are bare, and when we got here yesterday, he had nothing in the fridge but some apples and a wedge of Havarti."
"Since when does he even like Havarti?" asks Mummy. "Havarti isn't even a good cheese."
"He doesn't know how to shop. Ginny and Lucille, that's the new cook, only do what he tells them to do. He's been eating cheese toast. But I made a huge list, and they went to the Edgartown market. We have enough for a few days now."
Mommy shivers. "It's good we're here." I stare at the new building while the aunts talk. I knew Granddad renovated, of course. He and Mummy talked about the new kitchen when he visited just a few days ago, the fridge and the extra freezer, the warming drawer and spice racks. I didn't realize he'd torn the house down, that the lawn was gone and the trees, especially the huge old maple with the tire swing beneath it. That tree must have been 100 years old. A wave surges up, dark blue, leaping from the sea like a whale. It arches over me. The muscles of my neck spasm. My throat catches. I fold beneath the weight of it. The blood rushes to my head. I am drowning. It all seems so sad. So unbearably sad for a second. To think of the lovely old maple with the swing. We never told the tree how much we loved it. We never gave it a name. Never did anything for it. It could have lived so much longer. I am so, so cold.
Cadence, Mummy is leaning over me. I reach and clutch her hand. Be normal now, she whispers. Right now.
What?
Because you are. Because you can be.
Okay. Okay. It was just a tree. Just a tree with a tire swing that I loved a lot.
Don't cause a scene, whispers Mummy. Breathe and sit up.
I do what she asks as soon as I am able, just as I have always done.
Aunt Carrie provides distraction, speaking brightly. The new garden is nice when you get used to it, she says. There is a seating area for cocktail hour. Taft and Will are finding special rocks.
She turns the boat toward the shore, and suddenly I can see my liars waiting. Not on the dock, but by the weathered wooden fence that runs along the perimeter path. Mirren stands with her feet on the lower half of the barrier, waving joyfully, her hair whipping in the wind. Mirren, she is sugar, she is curiosity and rain. Johnny jumps up and down every now and then doing a cartwheel. Johnny, he is bounce. He is effort and snark. Gat, my Gat, once upon a time my Gat. He has come out to see me, too. He stands back from the slats of the fence on the rocky hill that now leads to Claremont. He's doing pretend semaphore, waving his arms in ornate patterns as if I'm supposed to understand some kind of secret code. He is contemplation and enthusiasm. Ambition and strong coffee. Welcome home, they are saying. Welcome home.
Chapter 24. The liars don't come to the dock when we pull in, and neither do Aunt Bess and Granddad. Instead, it is only the Littles, Will and Taft, Liberty and Bonnie. The boys, both 10, kick one another and wrestle around.
Taft runs over and grabs my arm. I pick him up and spin him. He is surprisingly light, like his freckled body is made of bird parts. "You feeling better?" I ask.
"We have ice cream bars in the freezer," he yells. "3 different kinds."
"Seriously, Taft, you were a mess on the phone last night."
"Was not."
"Were too."
"Mirren read me a story, then I went to sleep. No big whoop."
I ruffle his honey hair. "It's just a house. Lots of houses seem scary at night, but in the morning they're friendly again."
"We're not staying at Cuddle Down anyway," Taft says. "We moved to New Claremont with Granddad now."
"You did?"
"We have to be orderly there and not act like idiots. We took our stuff already. And Will caught 3 jellyfish at the big beach and also a dead crab. Will you come see them?"
"Sure."
"He has the crab in his pocket, but the jellies are in a bucket of water," says Taft, and runs off.
Mummy and I walk across the island to Windermere, a short distance on a wooden walkway. The twins help with our suitcases. Granddad and Aunt Bess are in the kitchen. There are wild flowers and vases on the counter, and Bess scrubs a clean sink with a Brillo pad, while Granddad reads the Martha's Vineyard Times. Bess is softer than her sisters and blonder, but still the same mold. She's wearing white jeans and a navy blue cotton top with diamond jewelry. She takes off rubber gloves and then kisses Mommy and hugs me too long and too hard, like she is trying to hug some deep and secret message. She smells of bleach and wine. Granddad stands up but doesn't cross the room until Bess is done hugging.
"Hello there, Mirren," he says jovially. "Grand to see you."
"He's doing that a lot," Carrie says to me and Mummy, calling people Mirren who aren't Mirren.
"I know she's not Mirren,"
Granddad says. The adults talk amongst themselves, and I am left with the twins. They look awkward in Crocs and summer dresses. They must be almost 14 now. They have Mirren's strong legs and blue eyes, but their faces are pinched.
"Your hair is black," says Bonnie. "You look like a dead vampire."
"Bonnie!"
Liberty smacks her. "I mean, that's redundant because all vampires are dead," says Bonnie. "But they have the circles under their eyes and the white skin like you do."
"Be nice to Katie," whispers Liberty. "Mom told us."
"I am being nice," says Bonnie. "A lot of vampires are extremely sexy. That's a documented fact."
"I told you I didn't want you talking about creepy dead stuff this summer," says Liberty. "You were bad enough last night." She turns to me.
"Bonnie's obsessed with dead things. She's reading books about them all the time, and then she can't sleep. It's annoying when you share a room."
Liberty says all this without ever looking me in the eye.
"I was talking about Katie's hair," says Bonnie. "You don't have to tell her she looks dead."
"It's okay," I tell Bonnie. "I don't actually care what you think, so it's perfectly okay." Chapter 25. Everyone heads to New Claremont, leaving me and Mummy alone at Windermere to unpack. I ditch my bag and look for the liars. Suddenly, they are on me like puppies. Mirren grabs me and spins me. Johnny grabs Mirren. Gat grabs Johnny. We are all grabbing each other and jumping. Then we are apart again, going into Cuddle Down. Mirren chatters about how glad she is that Bess and the Littles will live with Granddad this summer. He needs somebody with him now. Plus, Bess with her obsessive cleaning is impossible to be around. Plus, again, and even more important, we liars will have Cuddle Down to ourselves. Gat says he is going to make hot tea, and hot tea is his new vice. Johnny calls him a pretentious ass face. We follow Gat into the kitchen. He puts water on to boil. It is a whirlwind, all of them talking over each other, arguing happily, exactly like old times. Gat hasn't quite looked at me, though. I can't stop looking at him. He is so beautiful, so Gat. I know the arc of his lower lip, the strength in his shoulders, the way he half-tucks his shirt into his jeans, the way his shoes are worn down at the heel, the way he touches that scar on his eyebrow without realizing he's doing it. I am so angry and so happy to see him. Probably he has moved on like any well-adjusted person would. Gat hasn't spent the last 2 years in a shell of headache pain and self-pity. He's been going around with New York City girls in ballet flats, taking them to Chinese food and out to see bands. If he's not with Raquel, he's probably got a girl or even three at home.
Your hair's new, Johnny says to me.
Yeah. You look pretty, though, says Mirren sweetly.
She's so tall, says Gat,
busying himself with boxes of tea, jasmine and English breakfast and so on.
You didn't used to be that tall, did you, Katie?
It's called growing, I say. Don't hold me responsible. 2 summers ago, Gat was several inches taller than I. Now we are about even.
I'm all for growing, says Gat, his eyes still not on my face. Just don't get taller than me.
Is he flirting?
He is. Johnny always lets me be tallest,
Gat goes on.
Never makes an issue of it.
Like I have a choice, groans Johnny. She's still our Katie, says Mirren loyally. We probably look different to her, too. But they don't. They look the same. Gat in a worn green T-shirt from 2 summers ago, his ready smile, his way of leaning forward, his dramatic nose. Johnny, broad-shouldered in jeans and a pink plaid button-down so old its edges are frayed, nails bitten, hair cropped. Mirren, like a pre-Raphaelite painting, that square Sinclair chin. Her long, thick hair is piled on top of her head, and she's wearing a bikini top and shorts. It is reassuring. I love them so. Will it matter to them, the way I can't hold on to even basic facts surrounding my accident? I've lost so much of what we did together summer 15. I wonder if the aunts have been talking about me. I don't want them to look at me like I'm sick or like my mind isn't working.
Tell about college, says Johnny. He's sitting on the kitchen counter. Where are you going?
Nowhere yet. This truth I can't avoid. I am surprised they don't know it already.
What?
Why? I didn't graduate. I missed too much school after the accident.
Oh, barf! Yells Johnny. That is horrible! You can't do summer school?
Not and come here. Besides, I'll do better if I apply with all my coursework done.
What are you going to study?
Asks Gat. Let's talk about something else.
But we want to know, says Mirren. We all do.
Seriously, I say, something else. How's your love life, Johnny?
Barf again.
I raise my eyebrows.
When you're as handsome as I am, the course never runs smooth, he quips.
I have a boyfriend named Drake Loggerhead, says Mirren. He's going to Pomona like I am. We have had sexual intercourse quite a number of times, but always with protection. He brings me yellow roses every week and has nice muscles. Johnny spits out his tea. Gat and I laugh.
Drake Loggerhead? Johnny asks.
Yes, says Mirren. What's so funny?
Nothing.
Johnny shakes his head. We've been going out 5 months, says Mirren. He's spending the summer doing Outward Bound, so he'll have even more muscles when I see him next.
You've got to be kidding,
Gat says. Just a little, says Mirren. But I love him. I squeeze her hand. I am happy she has someone to be in love with. I'm going to ask you about the sexual intercourse later, I warn her. When the boys aren't here, she says, I'll tell you all. We leave our teacups and walk down to the tiny beach, take our shoes off and wiggle our toes in the sand. There are tiny, sharp shells. I'm not going to supper at New Claremont, says Mirren decisively. And no breakfast either. Not this year.
Why not? I ask.
I can't take it, she says. The aunts, the littles, Granddad. He's lost his mind, you know.
I nod.
It's too much togetherness. I just want to be happy with you guys down here, says Mirren. I'm not hanging around in that cold new house. Those people are fine without me.
Same, says Johnny.
Same, says Gat.
I realize they discussed this idea before I arrived.
Chapter 26. Mirren and Johnny go in the water with snorkels and fins. They kick around looking for lobsters. Probably there are only jellyfish and tiny crabs, but even with those slim pickings, we have snorkeled at the tiny beach, always. Gat sits with me on a batik blanket. We watch the others in silence.
I don't know how to talk to him. I love him. He's been an ass. I shouldn't love him. I'm stupid for still loving him. I have to forget about it. Maybe he still thinks I am pretty, even with my hair and the hollows beneath my eyes. Maybe. The muscles of his back shift beneath his t-shirt, the curve of his neck, the soft arch of his ear, a little brown mole on the side of his neck, the moons of his fingernails. I drink him up after so long apart.
Don't look at my troll feet, says Gat suddenly.
What?
They're hideous. A troll snuck into my room at night, took my normal feet for himself, and left me with his thuggish troll feet.
Gat tucks his feet under a towel so I can't see them.
Now you know the truth.
I am relieved we are talking about nothing important. Wear shoes.
I'm not wearing shoes on the beach.
He wiggles his feet out from beneath the towel. They look fine.
I have to act like everything's okay until I can find that troll. Then I'll kill him to death and get my normal feet back. Have you got weapons?
No.
Come on.
There's a fire poker in Windermere.
All right. As soon as we see that troll, we'll kill him to death with your fire poker.
If you insist. I lie back on the blanket and put my arm over my eyes. We are silent for a moment.
Trolls are nocturnal, I add.
Katie,
Gat whispers. I turn my face to look in his eyes.
Yeah?
I thought I might never see you again.
What? He is so close we could kiss.
I thought I might never see you again. After everything that happened. Then when you weren't here last summer.
Why didn't you write me? I want to say. Why didn't you call all this time? He touches my face.
I'm so glad you're here,
he says.
I'm so glad I got the chance.
I don't know what is between us. I really don't. He is such an ass.
Give me your hand,
Gat says. I am not sure I want to, but then of course I do want to. His skin is warm and sandy. We intertwine our fingers and close our eyes against the sun. We just lie there, holding hands. He rubs my palm with his thumb like he did 2 summers ago beneath the stars. And I melt.
Chapter 27. My room at Windermere is wood-paneled with cream paint. There's a green patchwork quilt on the bed. The carpet is one of those rag rugs you see in country inns. You were here 2 summers ago, I tell myself. In this room every night. In this room every morning. Presumably you were reading, playing games on the iPad, choosing clothes. What do you remember?
Nothing.
Tasteful botanic prints line the walls of my room, plus some art I made. A watercolor of the maple that used to loom over the Claremont lawn, and 2 crayon drawings. One of Granny Tipper and her dogs, Prince Philip and Fatima.
the other of my father. I drag the wicker laundry basket from the closet, take down all the pictures, and load them into the basket. There's a bookshelf lined with paperback.